Just need to be real close. No, this I can't see. The camera's gonna be right there, so I just want to have it. I know. And so when you tell your story part, come up, get yourself set, look at whoever's here, we'll read your introduction, and then the camera people want us all to take a second or two before we begin so that they can work with that.
Yeah.
And it's good building anticipation anyway for storytelling.
Okay. So how did you get the camera people?
Jessica would know. Or Susan would know. I think Jessica was like, hey, you know, this would be good stuff to do. And so
this is streamed? Or?
I don't know. It's not streamed.
Oh, okay.
I think they would like to use it for maybe some educational pieces.
Yeah, sure.
Right? So they know.
That's okay.
I know nothing, and I have almost no power or insight. Connections.
I was just curious. Although the panel isn't really it's audio recording, but I need to do transcription.
Maybe I'm going to lower this a little bit.
Oh, yeah, sure. It's
Is that okay?
Yes.
Can you still see it? That's not too...
I don't need to be staring at this.
Pardon?
I don't need to be staring at this.
Oh, no, it's okay.
I might just have to change my glasses.
Okay.
Did you have to find a runaround for the sound? Okay.
Oh, is he gonna be?
He's gonna do.
He's gonna
doing
run
a
out.
Backup, right, just in case the sound person doesn't.
Right. Okay.
She's just framing.
Yeah. Okay. No, I didn't. I didn't.
I'm just doing something.
Yeah. No, I appreciate that.
I don't know how to do
it. No one will accuse you of not being feisty, that's for sure.
Thank you.
Oh, I don't know. It was working earlier.
It's still turned on.
I hear it.
Yeah.
I'll turn it up.
No, we need you to talk to
Here, this is okay. Testing, testing, testing. I would put it up a little bit. Testing, testing. Testing. It's better.
We'll be starting in just a minute or two. They're fixing a couple technical things, so please talk amongst yourselves.
Thank you.
5 minutes?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
One over there and one here with this space.
Yeah,
okay. About 3 to 4 minutes. I want to thank everyone for their patience while we're waiting to make sure that we can get our sound quality good for this recording. We are recording this, and we're going to be posting these stories on UUA.org, and you'll be able to use them later. We've already had some people who've had some ideas about ways to use them in worship services, but you'll be able to use them as conversation starters within your congregations and UU communities. So we're sorry for the delay, but we really want to make sure we get a good recording. Thank you. Now continue talking.
Or to yourself. You know that. Oh, good.
My daughter's like,
here?
Here.
Is that good?
Welcome. Welcome to Rethinking We, a Unitarian Universalist Storytelling Jam and program number 231. We are your hosts. I'm Kristen Mayer.
And I'm Jessica York. The ability to tell our stories is a louder? Thank you. The ability to tell our stories is a sacred act of meaning making, of self-definition, and of self and community expression. When truth is told through story, it is also an act of humility and tremendous power.
The ability to hear another's story is also sacred, and perhaps more so. To truly listen to another's story is more than just about hearing. To a certain extent, we have to make ourselves vulnerable as listeners. It requires us to open our minds and our hearts and allow ourselves to be changed. It requires a willingness to see the world and our place in it a little differently.
Our theme for this storytelling event is Rethinking We. It is an invitation for tellers and listeners to rethink who all of us are who make up Unitarian Universalism. The theme was intentionally cast in a broad way, and our tellers will offer stories from a range of perspectives and experiences. But inside each story is an invitation for transformation if you're willing to engage that invitation.
Some of these stories will make us laugh, and some of them might bring us to tears. Some of them will fill us with pride, and some may feel like a punch in our Unitarian Universalist gut.
So please, we encourage you to laugh when it's appropriate to laugh, cry if you're so moved, applaud when applause is fitting. And when applause or words cannot do justice to the experiences told, let your deep silence speak, or show the teller that your heart has been touched.
And to help ground us in a sacred space for hearing these stories, Yuri Yamamoto will offer a song. Yuri?
Please feel free to repeat after me. Listen, 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 listen to my story, so you may know me, so you may know me better. Sharing a story of my own choice. For this brief moment, I ask you to suspend your own voice and, with no judgment, assumptions, or distractions, let my story seep into your heart. When the time comes for you to speak, I'll do my part to listen, to listen, listen, listen to your story. So I may know you, so I may know you better, 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 better.
Christian Mayer serves as minister to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Northfield, Minnesota. She is the author of A Good Telling, Bringing Worship to Life with Story.
I was the last candidate of the day to go before the Ministerial Fellowship Committee. That's a group of people that has to decide who's ready to be a UU minister, who needs some work, and who may never be ready. They have a very difficult job, and they had seen many candidates before me, and then it was my turn. And it started out well. I lit the chalice and preached my sermon, which they seemed to like, and then the questions started. Please explain to us the historical roots of our polity and how it functions today. Please describe your own theology and how it relates to the streams of both Unitarianism and Universalism. Or here's a hypothetical. A member of your congregation calls you in the middle of the night. He's just been arrested for sexually molesting a child. What do you do? Challenging question after challenging question. And at one point, I turned, and there was a spot in the middle of my vision. It was a migraine aura. Millions of people get migraines with auras. And when I do, that spot usually becomes this geometric pattern that moves across the field of my vision. Sometimes it becomes this space where I can't see anything. It's like a fold in the time-space continuum. And often, I have word-finding difficulty. Now, there's something about brain chemistry, at least mine, where migraines are more common after a stressful event. But I was in front of the Ministerial Fellowship Committee. And I could have said something about it. I could have tried to explain it. But there's a lot of misconceptions about migraines, and I did not know how that would be received. So I just pushed on. They continued to ask me questions, and I would look them in the eye and answer as best I could. And I say, look them in the eye, because that spot in the center of my vision had become a fold, so that when anyone I looked at directly, it appeared as if they had one eye in the middle of their face, like a cyclops. It was a little distracting. But thankfully, we got to the final question. And they said, tell us about some of the Jewish rituals around death that you're familiar with, say as you're training as a hospital chaplain. Now, I had learned that there is a group of people from some synagogues in the hospital where I worked who would keep guard overnight outside the morgue, the body of someone who had died. I knew about reciting the Kaddish or sitting Shiva, but in that moment, I could pull up nothing. And I think I said, I can't think of any Judaic rituals around death right now. And Judaic was not the word that I had meant to say, but it seemed like the least of my problems in that moment. And thankfully, this was the last question. So they led me out of the room so they could deliberate. And they deliberated a long time. Finally, I was brought back into the room, and they said, well, we have a concern. You couldn't answer the Jewish rituals question, and you said Judaic-Christian rituals. I did, and a couple of heads nodded. They were concerned that I had the way too common idea that Judaism was just the rough draft religion of the true improved religion, Christianity. That it is common, right? And that maybe I thought that Unitarian Universalism was a Christian movement, specifically or exclusively. And my first response was, what? I don't think that at all. But there were Jewish UUs on the panel, and they felt diminished by all of that. So I didn't try to defend myself. Instead, I simply apologized. I looked them in the eyes, and by that point, they had two again. I looked them in the eyes, I said I was sorry, and I meant it. Later on, I heard that some had heard me say Judeo-Christian and some hadn't. And I also heard that every candidate before me in that group had blown the Jewish ritual question, which didn't make me feel better, actually, because I think we had a problem. And to some degree, I was part of that.
And because I thought about it as my head was thump, thump, thump that night, but I had been thinking about the world religions questions, and there was a big stack of those, as about something out there, and Unitarian Universalism as in here. And that was really dumb. I had been thinking about world religions as something that an educated minister needs to know to do interfaith work, not that a caring UU minister or caring UU leader needs to know about her own people. I could have not had a migraine in front of the MFC. I could have said Jewish instead of Judaic or whatever I said, and I'm still not sure exactly what that was. I could have answered the question with what I knew. I could have gotten it factually right and still been getting it wrong in the big picture. And maybe it's a good thing that I didn't. Because now I serve a congregation. I did pass, by the way, the Ministerial Fellowship Committee. I serve a congregation. And in that congregation, there are UUs who are Jewish, UUs who are Christian, UUs who are Buddhist, as in like a Buddhist priest. And I don't need to be an expert in any of those traditions to know that what's important to them about their tradition or their background or their practice is important to me, because they are we, and we are all of us. Thank you.
Go ahead and get settled.
Good. Okay, I think we're good.
Reverend Tom Capel serves DuPage Unitarian Universalist Church in Naperville, Illinois. Reverend Tom has a marriage and a family therapist before his call to, he was a marriage and family therapist before his call to ministry. He has served on the Prairie Star District Board, and he's a trained lead mentor.
Stories. Stories have a beginning and an ending, you see, but where they begin and how they end depends on the person telling the story. In this case, it's me. And since this is my story, today's stories will be a little different than normal, with three beginnings and no ending, you see. And just to be clear, as our story progresses, at times I might carry a rhyme or even a rhythm, but don't expect too much of me in these things. It is sermons I write, not poetry. So here we go on this journey together. A place, a beginning, and this is the first of our three. So I invite you to open your ears, to hear what you hear, and see what you shall see. There was a man, not unlike myself, a bearded fellow with glasses, a little balding, on top that is, a man who might be me, really could be me, most probably is me. The man had been a part of a number of groups with names like congregation or society, fellowship or church. But all of these groups called themselves Unitarian, or to be more precise and correct, Unitarian Universalist. The man joined these groups and he became quite involved, and in short order, to be a board member, he was called. And lately, he became a thing most unusual, a thing we call minister, at least in this denomination. And this minister, this man not unlike myself, discovered that just as the UU groups were all the same and seemed different, so too this thing called minister, amorphous it was, he found it to be different wherever he went. In some of these groups, the minister, she simply preached in the Sunday morning when we should all actually be asleep. And some of these groups, this minister thing, she created a vision and called the group, "Hey, let this be our mission." In some of these groups, the minister thing was jack of all trades, cleaning bathrooms, setting up chairs in neat rows, and occasionally, yes, occasionally, she even preached to those who would sit in those chairs he set up neatly. The man who might be me observed ordained ministry through all of his years and through all of his wandering. And always he wondered and always he queried, what is this thing called a minister, this thing that might be me, that serve these UU groups? And what shall I be? The story has three beginnings and no discernible end. So here's another beginning. Just lend me your ear to bend. There was a group who called themselves DuPage Unitarian Universalist Church, DUC for short. Now some would say they looked like a duck and sounded like a duck, but they were most emphatically and intentionally, most emphatically not a duck, just DUC. They had had many minister things, yes they had, ones who put forth visions and ones who'd preached not so bad, ones who were gifted as counselors or admins, and ones who stayed long, while others, not so much. Some who were settled and some were called interims, and through all these years, these DUCs to found this minister thing confusing. Wondering sometimes out loud they did, what is this minister thing? Is she a preacher, a confidant, an admin, or teacher? Perhaps she's a prophet. And still they wondered, what is this minister thing, and do we really want it? And so these members brought forth a great sage, a district exec from far away, a district of Heartland, or at least so they say. And this DE listened to their wanderings and questions, and she paused with a thoughtful expression, and said to these wondering seekers, these DUCers, the minister is not the church. You, all of you, my friends, are the church. It is your responsibility to make this church thrive, not the minister thing that you ask my advice. You see, you need both a weak culture and a minister thing to be a success and to achieve your visioning. Those gathered looked at one another, and they saw with new eyes and repurposed themselves to a common commitment to thrive. They decided they would embrace this new way of being. They would no longer be like cats that needed a herding. So first they decided that what they needed was space, a space for more people to join in this we race. And lo, that they did. What they set out to do, they built a large building and called it a sanctuary, too. As I said, my friends, my story has three beginnings and no discernible end. The story has one more beginning, and I invite you to listen and see that these beginnings, well, they'll all come together quite nicely, I hope. This DUC, this Unitarian group, decided to find a minister thing, a new one, who would be part of this weak culture, this new way to be. So they talked among themselves and discerned what they wanted, a minister they might also believe, as they did, that they were the church, not this minister thing. Only working together, we church and minister thing, could they succeed and grow to be what they wished to be? A small group of them adventured quite boldly to explore the ranks of these multiple minister things. On websites and records, they looked, they talked with minister things, with phone calls, through Skype meetings, with email and text, until they found a person with glasses and beard, a head little balding on top. A person who might, well, actually, truly, it was me. I joined this UU church with joy in my heart, just wanting to love them. I wanted to be their minister thing, but was not entirely sure what kind of minister thing this group wanted me to be. A preacher, a sextet, a visioner, an admin, perhaps a counselor, as once I had been. Did they want me to be all of these things or none? I was unsure. So when I arrived, I found these people, these adept leaders, wanted their minister thing to embrace their new way. They, all of them, knew this minister thing was not the church. It was them they knew. These people worked hard to get things done, for they were the church. They worked, yes, they did, with patience and sweat, with compassion and love, all part of this we culture, which together they built. They, all of them, were the church, don't you see? And so now, as I join them, I'm their minister thing. And how do I fit in this we culture, I wondered. What about me? Well, that, my dear friends, is the most interesting part. They expected me to lead them, but not all the time, just for my part. And when I had the expertise, the training, the knowledge and skill, well, when these were not failing, I would lead them. But shockingly, they knew I couldn't do it all, and neither could they. But together, we could. If we worked really hard, if we worshiped together, meditated or prayed, and opened our hearts to each other, we could succeed. We could be more. I know now I am a leader who can follow. This following is an act of faith for me and them, and by no means is it shallow. We walk side by side, we journey together toward a common goal, one communally discerned and owned by us all. We co-minister, we DU seers who are not ducks. We completed a plan for the next 5 years together in really short span. We completed it quickly, this strategic plan. This plan resulted in a strategic plan implementation team, or SPIT we called it. Now I know as acronyms go, it's not that slick, but spitting we go, and with spitting we'll stick. And in short order, we culture of we, of minister thing and congregation, did get our spit together and are moving ahead, a future ongoing. Now, while I'll stop talking, the story is not ended. For I and this group will continue, you see, with our we culture, just them and little old me.
Reverend David McFarland has served churches in Provincetown, Massachusetts, the San Francisco Bay Area, Logan, Utah, and for 10 years, Allegheny UU Church in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, one of our few remaining historic inner city churches.
I thank my ancestors. I thank my elders who brought us here, who brought me here, some of whom are in this room. May the words of my heart and the meditations of my soul be acceptable in thy sight, my strength and my redeemer. People are dying in the streets. People are being shot dead. Not in abstract streets, in the streets, in our neighborhood, at Allegheny Unitarian Universalist Church in Ennis City, Pittsburgh. When I first got there, I was struck by how close the gunshots and the deaths were. And we decided, together with talking in the community, to hold an All Souls vigil for those people who had died that we could walk to in our neighborhood. And as the years went by and the numbers fluctuated, first year it was 7, then it was 9, then it was 13, then it was 11, then it was 6, the questions arose, are we really doing anything helpful? Is this really something that we should be doing? Are we making a difference? And then I met All Souls Joel. Joe, his real name. And what we would do is we would walk around the neighborhood, sometimes with bagpipes, sometimes just in silence. And sometimes, as people would, we were walking through the streets, notice who we were, and sometimes they'd ask, and sometimes they'd just join in. And Joe was one of the ones who joined in. I noticed him. He was a little more dressed up than usual, with who seemed to be a girlfriend or a family member. He was an African-American man of a certain age in a neighborhood that's about half black and half white. And at the end of the time, back in the sanctuary, as I do, I would walk around and talk to people who I hadn't met before. And I went up to Joe and his girlfriend and introduced myself, and he introduced himself. And he said, the beginning of the story. The story is, I just got out of fill in the institution, and I need to get to fill in the nearby, but not too close, destination, and I need a bus fare of $23.17 or $13.94 or whatever it may be. It's kind of the street equivalent of those emails that some of us get that say, I've been lost in Uzbekistan for my, you know. He said the beginning of the story, and I was so full of the evening that I didn't get in my judgmental space. I just, you know, okay, I'm ready. And he paused. My name's Joe. I just got out of prison just today. I had no idea people cared. I never saw Joe again. Joe never graced our sanctuary again, as far as I know. But Joe is a reminder to me, when I'm rethinking we aren't just the people who sign the book, pledge, show up at actions, join committees. Joe reminds me of who we are. The people who, when someone walks or moves over that threshold, bruised, beaten, bloodied, with their heart in their stomach or dragging behind them, or those who we touch when we walk outside our walls, they teach us who we is. And All Souls Joe is we.
Lori Buschbaum is entering her 31st year of ministry, though it took her a few years, she says, to realize that theology and ministry is mostly about hearing and telling stories. If she were not here at GA, she would be hiking in the mountains, making a quilt, or growing peas in her garden.
Hold out your right hand. In it, put this. 33 years ago, when I was in seminary, I attended an excellent week-long seminar on human sexuality. Think of it as OWL for seminary students. On day three, we watched a film on sexuality and aging. About 5 minutes into the film, my body started to tremble. About 8 minutes into the film, the trembling turned to shaking. And then in one lightning bolt moment, a revelation came, shot through my being. The revelation was something I had never even considered before. It seemed completely out of the blue. And the message in the revelation was this. I had been sexually abused by my grandfather. Now, the next day, I called my parents and said, and they said that one of my five older sisters had also shared this kind of news with them some years ago. Now, how my parents handled that situation is another whole story for another day. Let's just say that I felt as if my life had been built on this big, dark hole. And yet, suddenly, certain things also made sense. Needless to say, I did a lot of therapy over those next 5 years. Now, hold out your left hand. In it, put the story of a boy. I'll call him Jeremy, though that's not his real name. Jeremy grew up very poor in Maine with a mother who was mentally ill. His father abandoned the family, and at times the only way she thought she could put food on the table was to rent her young son out for sex. In his early teen years, Jeremy turned to alcohol and drugs to numb his emotional and spiritual pain. He became an addict. He married, divorced, used and abused drugs, spent a little time in jail, his heart and soul full of rage and longing, confusion, and a desire for love like all of us. Jeremy married again, a woman whom he loved, who struggled with mental illness. They had two daughters. Their family, too, was poor. Their formal education ended at high school, and they had no professional skills. For reasons that were cast in him through his own abuse, Jeremy instigated a sexual relationship with his daughter's babysitter. On one level, it was not a violent encounter. But I know as the adult, Jeremy was responsible for the abuse. And sexual abuse is always, in some ways, violent because boundaries are broken. I know this. Thank goodness the babysitter told her mother. Jeremy was arrested, tried, and spent 5 years in prison. But prison was one of the best things that happened to Jeremy. How could I know this, you might ask? One day, about 4 years ago, I got a letter from a man I had never met. His name was Jeremy, though this is not his real name. He was in prison for sexual abuse and would be released in 3 months. To the town in which I was serving as a UU minister. He wanted to come to church. He had discovered Unitarian Universalism in prison through the CLF. He had had a CLF pen pal for 2 years. He finally felt like he had a spiritual community, a path that made sense, a faith he could call his own, and a history he wanted to be a part of. I wrote back to Jeremy and told him that it would take me a year to try to work through with the congregation the possibility of his attending church. I told him I could not promise him that he would be welcomed, but that we would consider it and let him know. He said he understood. Jeremy and I stayed in touch, and when he got out of jail, we met frequently for coffee. I loaned him books on Unitarian Universalism, and he devoured each and every one. I learned about his life growing up in a deeply dysfunctional family. I learned about his pain. I learned that in some ways, prison was the best thing that ever happened to him because he attended AA and now had 5 years of sobriety. He went through sex offender training and or treatment and accomplished all of his goals. I talked with his case managers and parole officers. Not all sex offenders are the same. Jeremy was at low risk for reoffending because he had learned about himself and his family and how he came to be who he was. He was gaining the skills to choose a new path. He was devoted to his wife and daughters and hoped to share his new health with them. I also learned through Jeremy that once a sex offender, it is difficult to live in society again. The laws make it nearly impossible, even for those who do the work, have paid the price, and want to contribute to society again. But that, too, is another whole story. Over the course of the year, I worked with the church board, and they were willing to take a risk on Jeremy. They became educated on sex offenders. They read UUA materials and Deborah Hafner's wonderful resources. We double-checked and triple-checked all of our safe congregation policies and made sure they were all in place. We had a limited access agreement written with him and a bound behavioral covenant with Jeremy that stated that a board member would always sit with him at church and he was not to speak with children or youth at coffee hour. And all that work took a year. And then the day came. Jeremy was met at the door by his board buddy. They sat in the second pew. And when I welcomed the congregation that morning, I said, "Love is the spirit of this church, and service is its prayer. This is our great covenant to dwell together in peace, to seek the truth in love, and to help one another, to the end that all shall grow in harmony with themselves and with the divine." I looked at Jeremy. Both of us had tears in our eyes. And in that moment, another part of my childhood was healed. The right-hand story and the left-hand story were joined. My story and Jeremy's story met in a place of compassion. And I prayed that the little boy in him, horribly wounded through no fault of his own, was also healed. I want our faith to be big enough to be a home to us both. Blessed be. Namaste.
Yuri Yamamoto has worked at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Raleigh since 2003 and currently serves as the director of music. She identifies as a Unitarian Universalist of color in progress. I think that's the phrase you used. She is a Japanese immigrant, is married, and is the mother of 6 children.
So 2003, it was my first encounter to Unitarian Universalism when I was hired. Okay. So 2003, when I was hired as a pianist by my congregation, that was my first encounter with Unitarian Universalism. I loved it. I loved the sermons, and they had all kinds of cool workshops. I devoured them. Now, there are very few persons of color in my congregation, but I remember telling people that, you know, unless I look into my mirror, I can't see my own color. So, like, believing that meant that nobody saw mine, but that was a different story. Anyway, so, and actually, I didn't really share the history or the sentiment with the congregation in many levels. For example, I don't remember my parents ever speaking about the day that Kennedy was shot. But that was a big deal for a lot of people in my congregation. And there are some songs from 60s and 70s that I was told that everyone but me would know and love. But as an immigrant, I thought it was my fault that I didn't share these experiences or sentiment, and I tried very hard to become real American. In fact, since 1984, when I came to this country, I had been trying to become real American, who never looked like me. Now, fast forward to 2011, a major earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear accident hit my country, Japan. Now, 6 months before that, my husband and I actually became U.S. citizens. And in the process, we had to renounce any allegiances, if we ever had it, to Japan. But for whatever reasons, I became totally obsessed with Japan and Japanese people because of that disaster. And I didn't know why. I was really baffled by my sudden interest in Japan. And with that feeling still deep in my heart, I attended my first General Assembly in Charlotte, North Carolina. Now, Charlotte is a very multicultural city, if you knew it. But in a convention center, there are thousands of Unitarian Universalists, mostly white people. And that was mesmerizing to me. They looked like the sea of nameless white people. And I had a very difficult time. I went to a multicultural workshop led by Drum, and I saw a Chinese-American woman speak about her experiences of racism in her UU church. And she cried. Suddenly, I saw my color. It was like she just threw an invisible wire to me, and we were connected. My world turned upside down. I didn't want to become real American, which meant being white, anymore. I didn't know if I could go back to my congregation, which is vast majority white, and could still serve there. But I did go back. And what I found was not the sea of nameless white people, but people with names and relationships with me. So that was great. But, and I'm still there, but my new identity as a person of color stuck with me. And with that new identity, I started seeing some of the myths about Unitarian Universalists to be not true. For example, some of the songs that were told me, that people told me that they are beloved by everybody but me, it was actually not true. Some of the young people didn't grow up with those songs. They didn't experience the President Kennedy's assassination. Some people were like immigrants, like me. So I began to see some of the stories that we tell about who we are as Unitarian Universalists to be somewhat problematic. And since last year, I came out as a diversity activist in my congregation. And I tried to promote diversity and multiculturalism in my congregation beyond music. Music is my job, of course, but beyond that. And I have also been working with a couple other Unitarian Universalists of color and collecting the stories of UUs of color. And I have actually a workshop on Saturday on that subject at 1:15 is the next door. So I hope to see many of you there. But I still consider myself a Unitarian Universalist of color in progress. And the reason is when I see a lot of nameless white Unitarian Universalists, I still feel the sea of nameless white people rather than people with hearts and minds and stories. So I still have a lot of work to do to accept, in terms of acceptance and inclusion. So that's why I call myself in progress. So that's my story.
Jessica York serves the Unitarian Universalist Association as Director of the Faith Development Office. She is co-author of Bridging, a Handbook for Congregations, in addition to other curricula. Jessica is a mother, sister, auntie, horror movie fan, I didn't know that, Our Whole Lives trainer, and member of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Birmingham, Alabama.
The congregation tried four times to receive the certification of welcoming congregation. Not because they weren't a welcoming congregation. Everyone there was very welcoming. When we asked, should we do the welcoming congregation program, people looked around and they saw gay individuals and they saw gay couples and lesbian families, and they said, we're already welcoming. We don't need to do that program. For a second time, the minister and I asked, should we do the welcoming congregation program? And people looked around and they saw gay individuals and gay couples and lesbian families, and now we were offering our congregation as a site for a queer youth group in the city to meet. And they said, we don't need to do that program, we're already welcoming. Third time came around and we tried to do the program, but we didn't meet all the requirements. Fourth time was the charm. And the congregation became a welcoming congregation. They received their certification and they hung it in the narthex with pride, as they should have. And when the 1-year anniversary came around, the youth group that met there, the queer youth group, decided that they would host a worship service. It was going to be their way of both saying thank you to the congregation for doing the work of being a welcoming congregation and for welcoming them, but also a reminder to the congregation that the work is not yet finished.
I was an advisor to the youth group, and we worked hard on the worship service. And the day of the service came, and many from the congregation came. They were very excited to attend the worship service. And many of the youth came. Most of them had never been to a Unitarian Universalist worship service. Some of them were eager to see what it looked like to be part of a faith community that would actually welcome them instead of rejecting them, as some of their congregations had. One youth who only occasionally came to meetings and was just tangentially attached to the group came that Sunday. The youth was wearing torn jeans and a torn t-shirt, had some piercings, had some tattoos, multicolor hair, and was excited about being part of the worship service. While the worship service was happening, a few of us stayed out in the narthex to prepare for the potluck that was going to come after the worship service. And we were rather surprised that while we were laying out the dishes, the doors of the sanctuary swung open, and this youth came out, obviously very upset, looking close to tears. And we went to the youth and said, "Well, what happened?" And they said, "Well, I was sitting during the worship service, and I was enjoying everything, and there was this time called Joys and Concerns. And everybody was getting up and lighting candles, and they were sharing about these wonderful things that were happening in their lives. They were having birthdays, and kids were graduating. And it just seemed so wonderful to have this community of people where you could share something wonderful and beautiful happening in your life. And even though I'd never been here before, I just felt moved to share because I had something really important that happened in my life, too. So I watched everyone get up and share, and everyone applauded for them, and it felt so good. And I got up, and I lit my candle, and I shared with them that I had been on probation for the last year for breaking the law. But just this week, my probation officer said, my probation is over, and now I'm free. But nobody applauded for me. There was just silence. Did I do something wrong? Well, my first reaction, of course, to that was I felt anger. Those were my people, and I felt like they had let me down. My second reaction was to feel my heart breaking for this youth. We surrounded the youth, and we congratulated them on getting off of probation, and we talked about how wonderful that felt so that they wouldn't think anymore about what had happened in the sanctuary. And they stayed in the narthex, and they helped us set out the meal for it. Afterwards, I had a different reaction. Not that the anger wasn't there and the heartbreak wasn't still there, but I began to wonder a little bit to myself, how many times maybe have I been that person who was not as welcoming as I thought I was? What was I doing within this congregation and within this faith to make it a safe space for us to bring everything that we are to the congregation, especially to the sanctuary on Sunday morning? Was I creating a safe space where we could come, flawed individuals that we all are, where we could share our pain and our mistakes, as well as our beauty and our joy?
Ms. Kate Elliott, MBA, is a Chinook Native American from the Longview, Portland area who has served in a long list of leadership roles for the Chinook Indian Nation. She is a member of the East Shore Unitarian Church in Bellevue, Washington, where she is the co-founder and team lead of the Native American ministry team. As a descendant of a long line of Taiji chiefs and tribal leaders, She carries on the tradition of bringing Chinook and Native American cultural, political, and environmental issues to the forefront of the American people's conscience.
Masi Jessica. Leham, Kate Elliott, Naikinim, Chinookne. Hello, my name is Kate Elliott and I am Chinook. I am the daughter of Sherry Minsker, who is the daughter of Priscilla Jean Elliott, who is the daughter of one of our foreman chairmen, Tyee Nick Elliott, who is the son of Lucy Agnes Ducheney, who is the daughter of Cotlin Rondeau, who is the daughter of Ka'athel Chinook, who is the daughter of my fifth great grandfather, Chief Kumkumli. And anyone from the Pacific Northwest knows who he is. He was the benefactor of the city Astoria and Fort Vancouver, and he also wintered Lewis and Clark when they wandered out here for a winter. Why did I give you my heritage? Why did I give you who I am from my ancestors? Because that is something that we teach all of our children. We teach them to tell everybody who they are and where they come from. In our community, people will say, where do you come from? You know, who's your family? And we recite our family heritage. We're an oral tradition, an oral culture, and but it also serves a very strong political aspect. And that's because we are a unique cultural group, Native Americans in general, who have defied the US policy of genocide. We're still here. Thank you. All the injustices that have occurred to us over the last couple hundred years includes treaties dropped, land stolen, including the land you are on today. This is not ceded land. It has never been ceded to the US government. We've had our water polluted. We've had dammed dams. We've had our fish and our animals killed. We've been prevented from practicing our culture. We had our children sent off to Indian schools. We were told that if we practiced our culture, that our children's children would be sent off to Indian schools. Then we're told you're not Indian anymore. But we survived, and we're still here. My daughter this spring, she's 14, she's going to be a freshman. And she, as part of Washington State curriculum, learned about Western expansion and the doctrine of discovery, which of course she already knows about, thanks to our UU community and thanks to our Native American community. And she said, you know, sometimes, Mom, it's hard being Native American because the other kids just don't get it. They don't understand that we're still having an apocalypse today, but we're being told to get over it. We're being told Redskins don't mean anything. We're being told it doesn't matter that this land was never actually given to the United States government and that we can't have it anymore. My great-grandfather used to write articles for the Oregonian and used to go out and speak about all these dams, dozens upon dozens that he put on our beautiful Columbia River. And what did he say? He said that any conservation you're doing to save the fish today won't help if you build these dams, and what happens to the Indian will also happen to the white person. And look at our environment today. Look at where we're at. Now, being a UU and a Native American is a funny twist of fate for me, because I come from the Elliott family that came over on the Lion ship in the 1640s and built the Church of Roxbury, the First Church of Boston, and the Third Church of Boston, and some churches in Connecticut. So for me, walking these two paths, despite the fact that our beliefs, both in Native American and in UU, is to take care of each other, take care of the earth, and that all people have inherent worth, was pretty easy. However, I know for a fact that in this area, in about the 1950s, the community stopped supporting the Chinook, stopped speaking out. When they tried to move us to the Yakima Reservation, way before that, 100 years before, they protested and they said, let them stay. And they would be in solidarity with us, but not after about 1945, 1950s, not anymore. Yeah, it's pretty sad. And they started telling us we're extinct. So, what I have seen in the last 5 years with the Unitarian Universalist community is I have seen the doctrine of discovery being told, no, it's not appropriate, we won't take it anymore, we're not going to have it, and we're going to push the United States government to let them know that this is not okay. I see the College of Social Justice and the Solidarity with LUMMI, which I was lucky enough to attend, and standing there, and instead of saying,
"You need this," saying, "What can we do to help?" We have two events today, or excuse me, Saturday, where are focused on Native America. We got partnerships with original nations, and we also have the public witnessing. I hope you can attend both of them. We have the Commit to Respond. In my own East Shore Unitarian Church, one of the major pillars of the strategic plan for climate justice is to partner with Native American and local communities. The Duwamish, where our church is, are not fairly recognized either. Chief Seattle's people are not fairly recognized, also highly industrialized. So we have all these rays of hope, and that's where you all step in, because you are the front line of sparking and keeping the flame going for moral imagination and moral justice. Because as our friend Cornel West said, justice is what love looks like in public. It's true. It is true. So I hope that you stand with us and with those of us who are pushing to include the original people of the area in everything that you're doing, whether it's economic justice, climate justice, interracial, intergenerational, which is really important to us too. And you're great and you're lovely, and you've just made me over the last 5 years have hope again, which is something that my great-grandfather, my grandmother, my mother was diminishing. But for my daughter, for my children, for my grandchildren, for my great-grandchildren, I see us coming back like the salmon. We're coming back. Hayumasi, thank you very much.
And now we have our last storyteller. Meg Riley is senior minister of the Church of the Larcher Fellowship. Prior to that, she held a number of positions at the UUA, including for a time directing the UUA's Washington office. The story she tells today took place during that period of her life. Meg lives in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
September 11th, 2001. Bill Sinkford had just been elected president at General Assembly that summer, and it was his first time coming down to Washington, D.C. for Rob Keithan and I from the Washington office to take him around on a number of visits. So first we went down to the Senate office building where we'd been working for a while for poor women to come and testify about what the cuts in welfare, so-called welfare reform, looked like in their lives. The first woman stood up to speak, and when she did, a man in uniform came in and said, "You need to evacuate the room immediately." And I said loudly, "The minute poor people get the mic, they make us all leave the room." So we left. We herded out into a large parking lot where there were thousands of people milling around. Ted Kennedy walked by. There were senators and aides and staff. There were limousines that were stuck in gridlock, and everyone looked very, very wild-eyed. Rob and Bill and I had absolutely no idea what was going on. At that point, some Lutherans that we knew came by, and they had been in Senator Paul Wellstone's office and watched on television as first one and then two planes hit the World Trade Center. And at this point, there was a plane that was still at loose. The plane had hit the Pentagon, and there was a fourth plane that people thought was coming for the Capitol, which was about as far as that door from where we were standing. And there really was nowhere to go because we were in gridlock. And so as we stood there, I remember saying, "Something's on fire. Is that the White House on fire?" I was so disoriented. And Rob said, in words that felt like a slap, wake up slap, he said, "Stop it." I said, "Stop what? Is the White House on fire?" He said, "No, that's the Pentagon." And that's how disorienting the whole thing was. So a cab came by, and having no place to go, and again, total gridlock of cars and people, Rob and Bill and I went and sat in this cab so we could listen to the radio and get the story of what happened. And as we listened to it, I remember all of us repeating, as if it was a litany, the words, "Where the World Trade Center used to be." And we looked at each other, and we tried to figure out what we were supposed to do now. We all, of course, pulled out cell phones and started trying to call people we loved, and of course, everything was completely jammed. So we each made our own plans. It was very funny. I can say this now because Bill has really quit smoking, but at the time he thought no one knew that he smoked. So what Bill Sinkford was desperate to do was go have a secret cigarette somewhere. And so he said, I need to go to my hotel. So he left. And Rob, if you know Rob Keithan, said, I need to go to work. And that's what he did. He went back to the office. And I had a four-year-old, I said, I need to go home and see my family. And that's what I did. And Rob Hardy's at Washington, D.C. had just started his job on September 9th. He was a 29-year-old new minister. So he had been there 2 days, and he called me and he said, we're going to have a vigil tonight. Would you come and speak about the children? What do we tell the children? And I remember hastily writing something about what to tell the children. And when we went down, the whole city of Washington, D.C. was on lockdown. There was a curfew, and you weren't allowed to leave, but going to church was an exception. And All Souls Church was packed. It was packed not only with the usual members, but it was packed with neighbors of all kinds, people who saw that there was a service and came. And All Souls Church is blessed with many musical resources. One of them is that Esai Barnwell from Sweet Honey in the Rock was in the choir. And they sang the Sweet Honey song, No One Knows at Sunrise How the Day Will End. And I had never felt that song in my bones so profoundly as I did on that day. And I had never felt so much like I was in church as I did on that day, as people of all kinds with every theology who would never come to church again. One person actually said to me, Father, you're the priest, right? And I said, okay. That day, all the boundaries broke, and it was beautiful, and it said to me, this is who we are.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your patience and staying. And we had a little bit more planned, but we are just going to take this moment now to please thank the storytellers. They have brought their hearts and their experiences, and it was beautiful. Thank you to each of you for coming. I believe the best way we can honor these kinds of stories is to allow them into our hearts and allow ourselves to be transformed. So I hope that these stories take root in your heart and they transform you. I also want to thank Jessica for helping arrange this event, and hopefully we'll have more in the future. So thank you for coming, and if you want to talk about storytelling, I should add too, I will be signing my book in the UA bookstore, and I'd be happy to talk about how you can make this kind of event happen in your congregation. Thank you.